Today is Wednesday, November the 6th. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Hurricane Storms Helene and Milton have destroyed whole communities in the southeastern United States. You can make a difference. There are still many people in recovery mode. You can play a vital role in helping those affected to recover and rebuild their lives. Your donations to the Red Cross will help deliver essential services and supplies to those in need. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how Big Tech companies and our government are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a 3-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to Hank at pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.live, that's PRN.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your questions or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Apple offers free repair for bad iPhone 14 Plus with camera woes. Over the past few months, multiple reports have popped up on Reddit and Apple's official product forum regarding an iPhone 14 Plus issue that renders a black screen instead of a frame preview in the camera app. It seems Apple has finally caught wind of the complaints and has launched a servicing program to help affected owners. Apple has determined that the rear camera on a very small percentage of iPhone 14 Plus devices may exhibit no preview. Affected devices were manufactured between April 10, 2023 to April 28, 2024, says the company. iPhone 14 Plus owners who have faced camera issues can now get their devices fixed without paying any charge. Users can choose to visit a nearby Apple store or an authorized service provider, or they can send their unit via the mail-in route. It seems the camera issue raised its head in multiple ways. For some users, only the primary camera was affected, but others report the main and the ultra-wide sensors showed a blank screen in the camera app. A few user reports mentioning that accessing the front camera also results in a blank preview. Going by the language of Apple's update note, it is evident that this is a hardware-level issue and only professional repair can fix it. In case your phone has been exhibiting similar woes, you can check if your iPhone 14 qualifies for a repair service. If you have recently purchased a new Kindle, do you have discolored line on your new Kindle? If you do, you aren't alone. The new Kindle ColorSoft Signature Edition is the first full-color e-reader, and a lot of bookworms couldn't wait to get their hands on it. Sadly, many people are reporting the display has a discolored yellow area at the bottom of the screen, and the problem is so widespread that the Kindle ColorSoft dropped to an average review rating of 2.6 out of 5, although it does remain the best-selling e-book reader at the moment. The cause of the discoloration isn't clear. Some users report that it only happens when using the edge lighting feature on the Kindle, while others say it appears after a software update. Either way, the yellowing is a problem, especially on a device that Amazon has marketed as being great for comics and graphic novel fans. It's hard to enjoy the color work in a comic when it's distorted. Amazon hasn't given an official statement on the issue, although one Reddit user did post a screenshot that seems to indicate the company is aware of the issue and is working on a fix. The user was told by an Amazon customer service representative that an update would rectify the problem and asked them to check back in 48 hours. The response to the line has been mixed. Some users says it isn't noticeable. In fact, a lot of people didn't even realize the Kindle had the discolored section until someone else pointed it out. Others say the problem is too much of a distraction and detracts from the overall experience. Hopefully, Amazon will release a fix soon. If the problem is software-based, it should be easy to correct. If it's a hardware-based, though, it could be a lot harder to solve. If you're experiencing this issue, reach out to Amazon support. The more people that report this problem, the less time it would take to be repaired. New Chrome, Safari, Edge, and Firefox warning. Do not use these websites. With tens of millions of dollars stolen from hundreds of thousands of web users, a serious warning has just been issued for the billions of users of the most popular web browsers. Google has removed known websites from search results, but that will not eradicate links elsewhere, on social media and messaging platforms. It is critical all users know what to look for. Put very simply, you must not use these websites. Humane Securities Satori researchers warned that threat actors drove traffic to fake web shops by infecting legitimate websites with a malicious payload. This payload creates fake product listings and adds metadata that puts these fake listings near the top of search engine ranking for the items, making them an appealing offer for an unsuspecting consumer. When the consumer clicks on the item link, they are redirected to another website, this one controlled by the threat actor. On the dangerous website itself, users would be directed to a legitimate payment processing platform to buy their chosen product. That product would never arrive, of course, but the money would certainly be taken. While many consumers may be protected from the ultimate financial cost through credit card chargebacks, that's never guaranteed until a claim is investigated. In the campaign most recently outed, bad actors infected more than 1,000 websites to create and promote fake product listings and built 121 fake web stores to trick consumers, estimating losses of tens of millions of dollars over the past 5 years, with hundreds of thousands of consumers victimized. So what can you look for to avoid seeing your money disappear into a black hole? Product deals that look too good to be true usually are. If a bargain is being offered below market rates, do not proceed unless you can verify the site. Check consistency between website names and the names that appear in pop-ups, payment processing windows, and the URL. This specific campaign infected legitimate websites and then redirected elsewhere. Does the ordering process feel fully legitimate? Does it have the autofill address details, for example? Does it check the quality if the data you entered? If this is a website you have not used before, check reviews carefully. Remember, they can be fake, and look for known websites' reviews of the site. Can you find the product on a known website, even if more expensive? This campaign, dubbed Fish and Chips, that's P-H-I-S-H, and Ships, S-H-I-P-S, by the research team, included a number of sophisticated touches, metadata to hit the top of the search results, albeit Google has removed those known to be fraudulent, by infecting legitimate websites. In this instance, users would be lulled into a false sense of security initially, but the redirect to a fake web store is when alarm bells should start to ring. A list of all known fake websites can be found, some of which remain active despite the known threats as of this report. What you should do is do a search on the following words: list of scamming websites. This operation underscores the relationship between the digital advertising ecosystem and fraud, Santori says. Without the threat actors stage fake organic and sponsored product listings. There would have been no traffic to the fake web stores and therefore no fraud. A key takeaway from fish and chips is that digital advertising can be dangerous, and consumers should exercise caution when clicking through to the next step in the digital journey. Users of all major browsers fall victim to such attacks. The research team warns that fish and chips remain an active threat, albeit Google's takedown has partially disrupted its threat. It's unlikely the threat actors will pull the plug on their work without trying to find a new way to perpetuate their fraud. Now, I've gone on this site where I go to a list of scamming websites. It's a huge list. Some of the names I've never heard of, and some of them kind of look familiar. I will now have my senses high up when I see something from a new website. ~15 billion miles away, NASA Voyager 1 breaks its silence. On October the 24th, NASA successfully reestablished contact with the Voyager 1 spacecraft after a brief communications pause. Recently, Voyager 1 shut off one of its two radio transmitters, and NASA's team is now working to identify the cause. The shutdown appears to have been triggered by the spacecraft's fault protection system, which automatically manages onboard issues. This system conserves power by disabling non-essential systems if the spacecraft power supply is overstretched. However, it could take days to weeks for the team to pinpoint what exactly activated the fault protection system. NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, that's JPL, in Southern California manages communications with Voyager 1 via the Deep Space Network. When the JPL team sends instructions, Voyager 1 responds by transmitting engineering data, which helps the team assess its reaction to the command. This back and forth takes around 2 days, nearly 23 hours for the command to travel over 15 billion miles to Voyager 1, and another 23 hours for the data to return to Earth. On October the 16th, the flight team sent a command to turn on one of the spacecraft's heaters. While Voyager 1 should have had ample power to operate the heater, the command triggered the fault protection system. The team learned of the issue when the Deep Space Network couldn't detect Voyager 1's signal on October the 18th. The spacecraft typically communicates with Earth using what's called an X-band radio transmitter, named for the specific frequency it uses. The flight team correctly hypothesized that the fault protection system had lowered the rate at which the transmitter was sending back data. This mode requires less power from the spacecraft, but it also changes the X-band signal that the Deep Space Network needs to listen to. Engineers found the signal later that day, and Voyager 1 otherwise seemed to be in stable state as the team began to investigate what happened. Then, on October the 19th, communications appeared to stop entirely. The flight team suspected Voyager 1's fault protection system was triggered twice more and that it turned off the X-band transmitter and switched to a second radio transmitter called the S-band. While the S-band uses less power, Voyager 1 had not used it to communicate with Earth since 1981. It uses a different frequency than the X-band transmitter's signal is significantly fainter. The flight team was not certain the S-band could be detected at Earth due to the spacecraft's distance, but engineers with Deep Space Network were able to find it. Rather than risk turning the X-band back on before determining what triggered the fault protection system, the team sent the command on October the 22nd to confirm the S-band transmitter is working. The team is now working to gather information that will help them figure out what happened and return Voyager 1 to normal operations. Voyagers 1 and 2 have been flying for more than 47 years and are the only two spacecraft to operate in interstellar space. The advanced age has meant an increase in the frequency and complexity of technical issues and new challenges for the mission engineering team. Remember, these probes were made in the 1970s. Its technology is archaic and has been through decades of radiation. It's a miracle they still are communicating. In a shocking move, ARM cancels Qualcomm's license to manufacture Snapdragon chips. Qualcomm is almost entirely dependent on those licenses for its products. What just happened? The long-simmering battle between British chip designer ARM and American semiconductor superstar Qualcomm has just reached a boiling point. ARM has now given Qualcomm notice that it is terminating the license, allowing Qualcomm to create its own chips based on ARM's intellectual property. This architectural license agreement has been the cornerstone of the partnership that has kept Android smartphones humming with Qualcomm's cutting-edge processors for years. Now, according to documents viewed by Bloomberg, ARM has fired off a 60-day cancellation notice that could bring this long-standing deal crumbling down. For the uninitiated, the hostility between these two tech titans were once close partners stems from Qualcomm's $1.4 billion acquisition of chip design startup Nuvia in 2021. ARM alleges that when Qualcomm acquired Nuvia, it violated the licensing terms since Nuvia already had a separate agreement with ARM. The company's stance is that Qualcomm should have renegotiated those terms instead of simply absorbing Nuvia's existing ARM licenses. This led ARM to sue Qualcomm in 2022 for breach of contract and trademark infringement. Qualcomm, however, argues the existing agreement covered everything with Nuvia takeover. Using this as grounds, the company countersued, setting up an explosive courtroom battle that still looms. Both sides have also been quietly negotiating a potential settlement, but ARM's scorched earth license termination could indicate those talks have broken down or that it simply decided to go with the nuclear option. Now, in light of the notice, Qualcomm fired back that ARM is just trying to strong-arm a longtime partner and disrupt the legal process with his termination threat, calling it completely baseless. Following the acquisition, Nuvia's tech lived on as the Orion custom CPU core, now powering Qualcomm's latest Snapdragon X Elite processors for Windows on ARM laptops and Copilot Plus PCs. Qualcomm just announced new Orion-based mobile and automotive chips this week. If ARM does follow through on killing Qualcomm's license after the 60-day notice period, it could derail Qualcomm's multi-billion dollar mobile and PC chip business. The company might be forced to halt the sale of certain products, which generate nearly the entirety of its $39 billion in annual revenue. Qualcomm has a 60-day window to get its act together, which does seem like ARM's way of trying to strong-arm the company into settling this beef through negotiations rather than the courts. This whole thing comes down to money. U.S. Treasury Department, AI prevent or recover over $4 billion in fraudulent transactions. The U.S. Department of Treasury has made strides in combating financial crime through the use of artificial intelligence. In fiscal year 2024, the department recovered $1 billion in check fraud alone, nearly tripling the amount from the previous year. This success is part of a larger effort that prevented or recovered more than $4 billion in fraud overall, marking a six-fold increase from fiscal year 2023. The Treasury's Fraud Detection Initiative, which began in late 2022, utilizes machine learning AI to analyze vast amounts of data and identify suspicious patterns. This technology allows officials to sift through information much faster than human analysts, detecting anomalies and potential fraud in milliseconds. Renata Miskell, a senior Treasury official, described the impact of AI on their operations as transformative. The department is responsible for distributing approximately 1.4 billion payments annually totaling nearly $7 trillion to around 100 million recipients. This massive volume of transaction makes the Treasury a prime target for fraudsters, necessitating advanced detection methods. The AI systems employed by the Treasury focus on machine learning rather than generative AI. These algorithms excel at analyzing data streams and making rapid decisions on learned patterns. While the technology flags suspicious transactions, Miskell emphasized that human oversight remains crucial, with federal agencies making the final determination on fraud cases. The Treasury's adoption of AI for fraud detection follows similar practices already in use by many banks and credit card companies. The department is exploring further enhancements to its fraud detection tools, including testing new data sources and collaborating with state agencies to combat unemployment insurance fraud. The use of AI in financial crime prevention has become increasingly important as online payment fraud continues to grow. Juniper Research estimates that such fraud could exceed $362 billion by 2028. However, the technology itself presents new challenges, as demonstrated by recent incidents involving deepfake videos used in elaborate scams. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has acknowledged both the potential and risk associated with AI in finance. In June, she warned bankers about the significant risk posed by AI, and regulators have classified it as an emerging vulnerability to the financial system. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, the work environment for IT professionals, and so much more. Now, before I dive in, I'm going to note that I have been particularly lucky in this particular topic. I have gone through and I have worked for a number of companies that have realized a lot of the upsides of hiring an IT professional that's been in the industry for a very long time. However, there are a lot of different companies that overlook this. They go and they look at the idea, whether it's legal or not, they look at the idea of anybody who is an IT professional that is older than 35, 40, somewhere in there, that they're beyond hope. Look, there's no way that that person can know all of the different tech that we've got going on. And that's a complete misnomer. And that is something that falls apart very quickly. The problem is the industry keeps going in that direction, and they think, oh, for us to be on the cutting edge, the high end of tech, we need to hire in the young bloods and bring them in because they're going to be much better than those old dinosaurs. All right. So let's piece apart a few of the different things. Okay. Yes. The kids who are coming in fresh out of college, fresh out of trade school, fresh out of high school, they know a lot of these different programming languages. They are ready to go. They have no family. They have no life. No offense. They have a big focus. They've been told you've got to focus on work. You've got to look. It is very tempting because those kids are cheaper. Oh, yeah, they're going to work for peanuts. They will work for promises in startups that will never come to fruition. Oh, yeah, I'm working for an exciting startup, and I'm going to enter in at the ground floor, and someday I might be worth $20 million because this has so much promise, and it's going to go through the roof. I've got all of these stock options, which I don't understand. I've got all of these bonuses that'll come in if the company is successful. But then, of course, all of those kids forget the fact that, yes, the chances of that startup making it to that point where you become wealthy beyond all of these dreams is very low. So yeah, they're going to be cheaper. They don't realize the value of the dollar. They don't realize the value of the information they have. And yes, experience, while invaluable, gets overshadowed by those trends. And companies are dazzled by what's new rather than what is reliable. Here's the thing that the older folks do bring to the table. They bring wisdom. They've got business acumen. They've got critical thinking. They've got troubleshooting skills that are not taught anywhere except through the school of hard knocks. And employers need to realize this. They also need to realize that, yes, burnout is real, especially in IT. There is a constant level of the need to stay relevant. There is on-call rotations. There's late-night updates. There's emergency actions and reactions, and it turns into this big, huge work and personal life blur that will burn out those IT folks. And they say, okay, yeah, we can just pick up new folks. So burnout, you're burned out. Take the weekend off. That'll solve it. But here's the thing. All of those older folks that have been around, they know how to balance that work-life balance. They also realize that they can see the little red flags that are going along, and they will adjust. But those kids, they're not going to adjust. And, yeah, there is a certain level of, yes, the education that's out there. But you know, all of these educated students that are coming in, they're educated only on the book knowledge. They're educated on the different things that are taught by college professors who haven't been in the real world, if ever, recently, if ever. So we have to think about this. I remember taking a course, and the course was being taught by a professor who was referencing a language, a computer language that had long since been dead. And he was holding to this idea that we all need to learn all of these older things to deal with the modern things. And some of that applies. Some of that does apply for the workers who have the experience, but to dismiss the education level for the new things is kind of a tricky thing. And college is built up of a lot of those things. So we get kids who are showing up and they say, oh, I know COBOL and I know Fortran. Yeah, do you know any of the more recent languages? Well, no. And that's something I've seen along the way too. But here's the other concern we've got, and that is, yes, you can master some of those latest skills. You can go through and you can even learn a lot of the greatest things that we've seen yet in technology. You can master AI, but does that replace the many years of hands-on problem solving and working with people in a corporate environment? And the answer is no. Look, yes, if you're over 40 and you're in IT, yeah, maybe you should have a backup plan. You need to have preparations for what happens if they don't hire anybody over the age of 40 ever again in IT. But I think it's the businesses that need to come around. I think it's the businesses that need to shift their expectations and look for the gold in the old. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Amazon Titan rules on work from home. Employees must return to office. The work from home era is coming to an end for many tech workers, and Amazon is at the center of this shift. The company's recent decision to enforce a 5-day in-office work week has sparked major reactions among employees, with many expressing deep dissatisfaction. Amazon's new policy, which requires employees to return to office 5 days a week starting in January 2025, is facing heavy resistance. A survey conducted by Blind, a job review portal, reveals that 73% of Amazon employees are thinking about quitting due to this mandate. This poll, which involved 2,585 verified Amazon workers, were taken shortly after CEO Andy Jassy's announcements about the return-to-office policy. Amazon's return-to-office policy debate has reached a peak, with another bold statement from Amazon Web Services CEO Matt Garman following Amazon CEO Andy Jassy's earlier comments. Jassy, in a memo, stated that from January 2nd, all employees will be required to work from the office 5 days a week, emphasizing that in-office work fosters better teamwork, problem-solving, and strengthens the company culture. However, many employees have expressed concerns, particularly around long commutes, rising housing costs, and maintaining a healthy work-life balance. Although the rule is only starting next year, many employees are already seeking other job opportunities. Some worry that they will lose the work-life balance they enjoy during the work-from-home period. According to the survey, a significant number of Amazon employees are either actively looking for new jobs or know colleagues who have already left due to the policy. More than one-third of the respondents said they personally know someone who quit over this issue. Reports from Fortune support these findings, showing that many Amazon workers are rage applying for jobs with more flexible arrangements. Despite this, Amazon has not publicly addressed a growing dissatisfaction among its employees. Amazon's decision to enforce a strict in-office policy has raised concerns beyond the company itself. Many fear that other tech giants could follow suit, ending the flexibility that remote work has provided. According to Blind Survey, over 90% of Amazon workers oppose the new in-office rule, and employees from other companies like Google and AT&T have also expressed concerns. The fear of losing remote work options has grown, particularly as companies like Dell have introduced similar mandates requiring their sales staff to work in the office 5 days a week. Interestingly, while Amazon and Dell push for full-time office presence, the broader trend in the tech industry leans towards hybrid work models. The Flex Index, which tracks office requirements for over 9,000 companies, shows that 37% of U.S. employers now offer hybrid work setups, up from 20% at the start of 2023. In fact, only a third of companies still maintain strict 5-day in-office requirements, and many are easing their return-to-office policies as they face strong opposition from employees. Amazon's decision to mandate office attendance could have long-lasting effects on its recruiting efforts. According to the Blind Survey, many job candidates are pulling out of Amazon's hiring process because of the return-to-office rule. Amazon recruiters are struggling to fill positions as candidates are reluctant to give up the remote work flexibility they currently enjoy. In the current economic climate, candidates are turning down job offers, making it more difficult for Amazon to attract top talent. The shift towards remote work has made freedom and flexibility key priorities for many employees, and Amazon's policy may be at odds with these expectations. Amazon's decision to enforce a 5-day work week is clashing with the industry's broader preference for remote or hybrid work, while it remains uncertain whether Amazon will adjust its policies in response to the backlash. Continuing on this path could lead to losing valuable talent. In the coming months, Amazon may face significant challenges as it grapples with disgruntled employees, tougher recruitment processes, and an industry that increasingly favors flexible work arrangements. According to the ongoing discussion, Garman defended the company's stance at an all-hands meeting, making it clear that employees are unwilling to return to the office full-time have the option to leave. If there are people who just don't work well in that environment and don't want to, that's okay. There are other companies around, Garman said, while also clarifying that this wasn't meant negatively. He pointed out that Amazon has struggled to innovate and collaborate effectively with remote work, and that the previous 3-day in-office requirement wasn't achieving its goals. Garman stressed that the company needs face-to-face interactions to drive innovation and collaboration, key components in developing cutting-edge products. Companies tighten remote work policies amid rising resistance from employees. This change has occurred for various reasons. Some employers assume that employees are most effective working from the office setting. Research indicates that some companies are worried about slacking, specifically due to improper utilization of flexible working through the appearance of coffee badging, where employees just pop in at work, then out. With regard to the year 2025, one of the key trends which emerged with the COVID-19 period is the resistance which is building up against remote work among employers. According to the new survey, it is predicted that about 70% of employers are aiming to restrict or even decrease the level of remote working by implementing more stringent return-to-office policies. This is quite a change as years ago, having a remote or hybrid work model for some years, many companies are now trying to take back control over their workforce. The poll of more than 700 bosses found that 3 in 4 organizations are struggling to force impose return to office. While it's doubtful that this approach to recalling workers into the office will be beneficial, this response by the majority of employers lead to two critical concerns. First of all, compelling talented employees who benefited from work from home previously and incentivizing this with better pay and higher likelihood of promotions will, of course, cultivate discrimination gap and roll back any likely progression for groups like disabled workers and women down the career ladder, just to perform the same work, if not more, than their in-office white and or childless counterparts. Another concern is that this is yet another instance of micromanaging, which is when leaders and managers foster a lack of trust within the workplace. Management tracks down every action of their employees and treats them merely as human labor on a spreadsheet rather than adults who can be trusted and respected to get the job done. This change has occurred for various reasons. Some employers assume that employees are most effective working from the office setting. Research indicates that some companies are worried about slacking, specifically due to improper utilization of flexible working through the appearance of coffee badging, where employees just pop in at work, then out. Business and organizations are now starting to stamp out such kinds of behavior through stricter attendance and monitoring systems. This is counterproductive to in-office interactions in that it failed to strengthen the company culture and improve morale in cohesive teams. On the contrary, it fosters a toxic environment of arm's-length transaction dealings, embedded fear, and minimal compliance to the letter. Moreover, one must acknowledge that long-term consequences of the pressure to attend the office are not limited to particular firms. Examining from where we have started, we have seen how the total landscape of job market has transformed since the pandemic. With the 57% employees anticipating rise in flexibility, mentioning that it is one of their prerequisites they look for before applying for a particular job, and they are willing to switch their employer for a location or remote flexible role. Although forcing employees back into the office for more days or full-time might be a quick fix, it could be a short-sighted move that damages equality, trust, and culture long-term. Analysts forecast that a large number of employers will limit remote work even further in 2025. Organizations will have to tread carefully on one hand in an attempt to address employee expectations, while on the other hand, quell productivity fears and concerns. Thus, it is easy to state that the configuration of work is to change further in the future. The impact of the hybrid work model, balancing work and life. Hybrid work arrangements have led to a range of outcomes for companies that have embraced this model. Some results are positive, like increased productivity, and others are more challenging, such as weakened team dynamics. For some, the advantages of increased flexibility and autonomy are clear, while others struggle to maintain a strong company culture. While hybrid schedules are in demand, leaders must take care to ensure adequate exposure to others on the team to build relationships and teamwork. Opportunities to interact with senior leaders and provide development to hybrid team members are critical to ensuring growth and bench planning. All too often, hybrid team members are working in isolation with little exposure to teams and leadership. Flexible hybrid schedules allow employees to work longer when they otherwise would have taken the entire day off or even part of the day. This not only allows work to continue, but also alleviates stress for the employee. This is especially true in our customer-facing roles where coverage is essential. This may not be possible if interactions with customers are in person. The positive impacts include increased employee satisfaction and retention, an expanded talent pool, and better work-life balance. However, negative impacts include collaboration challenges, cultural shifts, and potential inequity. The key is to implement hybrid work thoughtfully. Companies should also regularly assess the impact on productivity, collaboration, and employee satisfaction, adjusting the approach as needed. Research shows hybrid work can lead to higher levels of workplace satisfaction and engagement. Employees with a voice in deciding where they work tend to enjoy higher productivity and better relationships with their managers. However, hybrid work presents new challenges with internal communication. Effective communication strategies, including tools and training for managers, are key to success. The success of a hybrid work model often depends on how well it is implemented and managed. Companies that thoughtfully design their hybrid policies, invest in necessary technology, and train managers to lead remote teams effectively are more likely to see positive results. Those who rush into hybrid models without adequate preparation may struggle to realize the potential benefits. Hybrid work schedules can ease stress for both employees and employers. Employees enjoy the flexibility to manage their work and personal lives, which helps reduce burnout. Meanwhile, employers benefit from fewer absences and higher productivity since happy, less stressed employees are more engaged. This balance creates a healthier, more productive work environment for everyone. Hybrid work offers the flexibility that many employees now expect, which can be a competitive advantage in attracting and retaining top talent. However, if a company relies heavily on in-person collaboration and in-office culture without the infrastructure to support distributed teams, hybrid schedules may hinder an organization's effectiveness. The impact of hybrid work is mixed because of the dependencies of the business model and leadership buy-in. Companies should adopt a hybrid policy because it is a recruitment and retention tool for flexibility. It is important to provide clear expectations for work hours, both remote and on-site, have communication transparency, and foster a culture of regular one-on-ones to optimize success. The impact hybrid work schedules have had on business is twofold. First, beliefs about what a remote workforce could do were shattered as the world moved to years of fully remote work. Second, the isolation that followed also reminded us the value of in-person interactions. Given all that, companies should consider adopting a hybrid work schedule because it's really the best of both worlds. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Marty Winston joins me now. And Marty,
hey, I have a riddle for you.
Yes.
Actually, it's more of a joke. It's about the nearsighted nerd who walked into a bar and said, "Oh, who left that bar there?"
Okay. On that note, what do you have for us this week other than strange
jokes. Well, I wanted to lead in with something corny because the other question comes up, what's USB for? And, you know, it's obviously for connecting things, but that's not what it's about. Hey, folks, there's a new thing coming, a new player in town called USB numeral 4. The USB you have now is USB 3. USB 4 is new and coming, and it comes in flavors that go from 20 to 80 gigabits. But at 80 gigabits,
that's a nice throughput, yeah.
If 80 gigabits is what you intend to do over the cable, that cable is only going to be about 15 inches long.
So yeah.
There's a lot to know about it, and let me try to dive in, but get into some specific examples very quickly.
Sure, yes.
From some old friends of ours. Now, if you follow all the tech factlets about USB 4, you might be salivating over the bandwidth, but as the song says, that ain't necessarily so. You might get 20 gig, maybe 10, because those tiers are also part of the standard. It offers, USB 4 offers two PCIe lanes, 20 gig each, and then there's tunneling, and there's been an expansion on the spec since then to get the 40 and 80. But unless you're creating something end-to-end that should have been over a different wire, don't worry about that part. Just don't worry about it. PD, power delivery for is 100 watts.
Okay, nice.
You can generally drive two 4K displays, but that depends on whether you want to include high dynamic range, HDR, because that's a bandwidth eater. You know, extra bright, direct sun in the camera kind of shots have the big bloom of brightness, and that needs HDR to be reproduced in full, and it doesn't want that going both ways. Now, the spec can drive a 4K display at 240 frames per second.
Okay. That's very nice.
And it's compatible with DisplayPort 2.1, but it's range limited. So some of its specs require cord lengths less than a couple of feet. When you have expectations for it, ask before you buy.
Sure, yeah.
Best advice. Now, I want to talk about USB 4 and actual products. I got a small selection in from our friends at Anker, A-N-K-E-R.
Nice, great, nice guys, definitely.
Yes. Got a couple of cables, 3.3 feet long. These are Series 5 cables. They're made for 20 gig. They're not made for the 80. I got the Anker 556. That's their product ID. I wish they had names. and we're about to see the difference between a hub and a docking station. The 556 is an 8-in-1 USB 4 hub, which means where it goes into the computer, it's plugging into USB-C connector, because USB 4 standard connector is USB-C connector. It supports an 8K 30 frame per second HDMI, an 8K 30 frame per second display port, Ethernet, a 10 gig USB-C, two 10 gig USB-A, and it's got power delivery input for up to 100 watts. So that is the hub. Now, the 568 11-in-1 USB 4 USB-C docking station has 100-watt charging, 230-watt charging ports, two DisplayPort 1.4, one HDMI 2.0. So you can run one monitor at 8K 30 on DisplayPort or 4K 60 on HDMI or two monitors at 4K 60 or three at 4K 30. You want three more monitors? Plug them in. There's two 10-gig USB-C ports, two USB 2A ports, two 5-gig USB 3A ports, all in a little thing you can put on your desk and not have to worry about your coffee falling off the edge.
I am kind of puzzled at the – so we can do one 8K 30, but only three 4K 30s. I imagine there's probably some overhead, probably some background.
Well, there's only one USB-C wire for it all to go over.
So
that's where the bandwidth gets constrained. DisplayPort 1.4 is pretty generous, and if you remember, DisplayPort 1.4 is the native on USB cable way to send video. DisplayPort, not necessarily 1.4. So one monitor at 8K 30.
Yeah.
There's not enough bandwidth for 8K 60. If you want 4K 60, you can deal with that on two monitors at once.
Sure, you know, sure, yeah, yeah.
Your port. If you're okay with 4K 30, you can have three of those. So it's, you know, how fast do you blink?
Yeah. So it looks like we are starting to get USB 4 items out on the shelf.
And it's starting to appear in notebooks, yeah, and computers.
Yeah, yeah. So definitely very timely that you're bringing this up. It's been a long time in coming.
Yeah. Oh, yes, development. Development. Well, who knows? Maybe it's a pandemic thing, but
sure,
yes.
Sure, yeah.
I really salute the guys on the USB IF who put so much work into the standard, working with the vendors to find out what's possible, what's desirable.
Definitely. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, November the 8th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is limac.org. The King's Bite Computer Club meets Tuesday, November the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, located at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. And for more information, the phone number is 347-278-7320. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a presentation, Voting Systems 2024. Was the election stolen? Thursday, November the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is nyacc.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation, Digital Wallets, Exploring the Future of Payments, Thursday, November the 28th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m., online virtual meeting. The website is bcug.com. Tech Ed Connect meets Tuesday, December the 3rd. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, December the 6th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.